What's the password?
Don't talk about it. Be about it.
Welcome in to the To The Point Home Services VIP room, where we invite you, the listeners in, to hang alongside some of the biggest, baddest, and most successful VIPs of the home services industries. You never know which surprise guest will show up next. So let's get this party started.
Hello and welcome. A little bit different voice doing the intro. First timer here. I'm your host, Chad. I'm joined with my co-host, Mr. Aaron Gaynor. And we are without the voice himself, no pun intended. Mr. Yano had a little procedure done on his throat. He popped on here earlier. And trust me, listeners, we wouldn't want him on here today, or we would just to crack jokes, but we will bust his balls a little bit for not being here, since he never misses an opportunity to bust ours if we, get busy and can't join in his little scheduled time slots, given that he doesn't currently have a job. Aaron, how you doing, my man?
I'm wonderful, man. Excited to be here with our guy today, Josh Campbell, man. I know Josh from back in the day, came up through NetStar with both of us, right? So excited to have him, man, in here today. Josh, welcome. And glad to hear Chris is okay, a little scratchy voice, but he'll be back on his feet and ready to go in the next week. So we'll miss him today, but we're going to have some fun today with a great guest, Josh Campbell. So Josh, welcome to the show, my man.
Thanks, buddy. It's good to see you guys. It's cool to be on with a bunch of old friends. Love this.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, it was funny when Chris, when Chris told, when texted Aaron and I, or texted us separately or whatever, and was like, hey, you guys are going to have to do the show by yourselves. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, like a lot of times I don't know the guest before we jump on here. And he goes, oh, it's just Josh. He'll be fine. I was like, oh, perfect. This lined up just perfectly. We could talk for quite some time. So yeah, happy to have you on, man. Excited for our conversation. I guess those of you that don't know you, maybe give us a little bit of your background down in the DFW area, taking care of the great people of Texas. Maybe give the listeners a little bit of background, and then we can start jumping in.
Yeah, sure. I'm the founder of Rescue Air here in Dallas, Texas. We're a premier air conditioning company. We service residential service repair, replace, plumbing, generator, HVAC is our, obviously Rescue Air. I'm a third generation mechanical contractor, really a plumber. My dad, granddad, all of our family has been in the trades forever. I'm one of those dudes who went into Lincoln Tech straight out of high school and, grew up going to Votech. I'm old, back when they had Votech in high school, right? Other stuff, I don't know. We did a private equity deal about 2.5 years ago, stuck around for about 2.5 years as the founder and a general manager for 2.5 years. Now I'm just like in a founder's role. So I kind of steer culture and just come in here and try to create a positive environment. That's kind of what life's about right now.
Well, that's exciting, man. So I know you did a deal. Remember hearing about that, but why don't we jump back real quick just to give people a little bit about your background? You got a really interesting story, if you don't mind telling a little bit. I've heard it a couple of times, like all the way from what happened to you, how you even got into trades real quick, into where you got again into Rescue Air and go, and maybe just give people a little bit about, the Josh Campbell that most people don't know, right? The story of the bad times, like these good times, because a lot of us go through that, right? And have to be able to figure that out. So maybe just share a little bit of that, if you don't mind.
Well, we might have to work into some of it if we really want to. I didn't never want to be in the trades. I grew up in the trades. Like there's a picture of me in the newspaper when I was like 8 years old with my granddad, and I was working on a gas pump meter. So our family built gas stations and we did all the in-ground fuel tanks and like a lot of hazmat stuff. But we literally do everything. When I was a little kid, I was on job sites running a shovel when I was like 8. And I was like in that newspaper article in the Northern Virginia Daily, which had nothing to do with Northern Virginia. It's an interesting newspaper, but I'm originally from Virginia and up in the mountains, like Appalachia more than Northern Virginia, the Shenandoah Valley. And if you went to a little gas station in Virginia, you probably had a 50-50 chance our family built it. And that's like since like the 70s. And before that, my granddad's dad was in the trades, you know, so it's a whole run of these Leonards. My middle name's Leonard. I watched those guys have these peaks and valleys all through my life. And I remember, you know, just growing up on a farm, like praying I could get the hell out of that world that I was in. I was like, I don't want to live like this. I didn't have air conditioning in my house growing up, if that tells you anything. We weren't poor. It was just like wildly conservative. We, you know, you're in a farmhouse, it's a big farmhouse, but like no air conditioning. I remember just staying awake all night saying, this isn't going to be my outcome. I'm not doing this. These pops and dad, they're all getting it wrong. Actually, there's a picture of the top of me right here. That's my granddad. That's a character of him from like 1976. Oh, yeah. I tell you what, it's a pleasant picture, but like, it's not. Because like he's got a phone in his hand. You probably can't see it. I should zoom in on it. But like it's 3 a.m. and it says how, like there's a bookshelf behind him talking about all this stuff. It's one of them says like how to get along with your kids and how working with family. There's an alarm clock that says 3 a.m. and he's on the phone in a recliner with a cup of coffee. I remember seeing that at their house, and my mom and dad or like his kids had that made for him like in the 70s. When he passed away, it was the only thing I wanted. And because it says so much about what I did not want in life. I was like, I'm not living that life. You know, there's peaks and valleys and all that stuff. But
ironically, you don't want anything to do with a little bit. You didn't have the air conditioner.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got suckered into the trades, man. I was at I was in Votech doing electrical in Votech, and I was pretty good. And like I competed in the electrical state wiring competition. If you've ever heard of one of these, the Virginia State Electrical State Wiring Competition. They'd set up all these booths and like 60 electricians and see who could wire it up the fastest and closest to code. I came in second in the state. The moral of the story, I went to a Lincoln Tech on a field trip with the Votech, and they administered a mechanical aptitude test. And I got a great score on it. I think it might have been a perfect score. And like which hot air balloon rises faster, which ski jump will launch farther. And I got a ride to this Lincoln Tech, and being frugal and conservative, it's like, well, you got a free education here. You got to go. And then the whole time I was sitting in Lincoln Tech up in Columbia, Maryland, I was devising my plan to like escape. And but the day I got out of Lincoln Tech, my uncle Mike, who's my business partner now, had already sold an air conditioning system to some police officer that he knew in Harrisonburg, Virginia. So like I'm literally graduating Lincoln Tech on a Friday. On a Saturday, I had a manual trying to figure out how to install a split system by myself. It took me 3 days. And then I got like my cut was like $2,000. And I was like, maybe even like $1,500, but like in 98, that was a lot of money. It's like, holy smokes. I was like, dang it. No, yeah. I think after that, I was sucked in.
So what happened from there? Yeah, that's great. What happened from there? So that's what happened. Now you're in Rescue Air. You grew Rescue. You went from there. Somehow you got to Rescue Air and you got to Texas. And then you grew a business. You sold it to private equity. So I think people don't want to hear that.
Yeah, there's a gap there. Oh, I 9/11 happened, right? And I'd been working on going to school, working for the family business. And then I'd actually started my first company. So I've had this entrepreneurial mindset. I'd lay in bed at like 3 a.m. and I'd be, you know, it was 100 degrees outside. We had no air conditioning. So I'm wide awake. I'd just be devising plans like how to build real estate or something to like compound interest. I'm doing math in my head, trying to figure out when I'm like 13, how to like retire young and all these dream ideas. Right. And then 9/11 happens in 01, working family business. And I got a call from the Pentagon, this contractor MC Dean, and they were the biggest government electrical subcontractor at the time. And they called and asked me to come work at the Pentagon and help rebuild. And I think everybody knows what they were doing back then. You know, I was after 9/11 happened, it was 5 days after the plane hit. I got the phone call and I was polishing my AR trying to figure out how I could go kill terrorists. And I'm like, I said, yeah, I'll do it. So I went up there and I stayed and helped rebuild the Pentagon for a year. That was terrible. I was just like the youngest junior project manager on site. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I knew how to read blueprints. I'd taken blueprint reading classes and stuff and grew up doing that stuff. But so I did that for a year and I hated it. The government work was not for me. You get halfway through a Monday and I'd have my entire workload for the week completed. And I'm like, I can't do this. I mean, I'm stir crazy. You guys know me. I'm busy, dude. And I'm like, so I'd be walking around the Pentagon. I'll tell you a fun Pentagon story. If you look at the Pentagon, it's a series of rings, right? And I remember one of the places I'd go to in the center of the Pentagon, right in the middle of these rings, there's this little cafe called Ground Zero Cafe. And you'd go in there for lunch. Like you could get outside, so to speak, of the building, but you were in the middle of the building. And I'd be in there eating lunch. And I remember when they told me, I was like, why is this called Ground Zero Cafe? And I remember this old Pentagon dude was like, there's more nuclear missiles pointed at this one exact location than anywhere else on Earth. I remember just like,
yeah,
like looking in the sky, like 21, thinking like, I mean, like got my sandwich and I'm like, all right, this is not going to be my outcome. So I need a better plan. So anyway, that's Ground Zero Cafe at the Pentagon. But so I leave the Pentagon after a year and I went to like an old, you remember those old Dodge Ram cargo vans that were like 2500s, but they're kind of miniature and they had like the orange light on the roof. So I go to an old equipment auction and I buy two of these things and I quit the Pentagon and started an air conditioning company and it was called Campbell Mechanical. And I ran that in Northern Virginia for 10 years. And then after that, I started doing all this commercial work. I was a hustler, right? I remember like I just started this company and I remember being like, we get early winters in Northern Virginia. It was like early December, snow on the ground. I'd drive around looking for job sites and I found a job site and I'd see a job site going. I'd just go up and ask who the GC was or who was running the project. And I'd say, hey, who does your air conditioning? I can do it better. Give me a chance. And I just hustle, man. Anytime I didn't have jobs that I was doing, I'd drive around looking for job sites and I'd go to the job site and I'd find, and those young, man, those contractors loved me. They thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. They're like, dude. So one of my best friends, Frankie, is his dad, Frank Barlow. I'm in Northern Virginia. I see this like warehouse thing going up. I pull it, it's snowing and this dude goes, I was like, hey, who's doing your air conditioning? He's like, well, I got this office. We're building one of these warehouses here. And this is on a Saturday. And he goes, if you could be here tomorrow putting sheet metal together, I'll give you the job. So I drove all over Hell and Creation, begging distributors to open up and give me metal. And then I was out there the next day hammering tin together, running like trunk lines. And this old dude pulls in there and he goes, hey, dude, he's like, Josh, you need to meet my son. First off, he goes, what the hell are you doing here? It's a Sunday in the middle of winter and you're banging together metal. And so I was like, you said to give me the job. I came in tomorrow. I didn't mean that. And I was like, I didn't realize you'd actually show up. He's like, you need to meet my son. He's like, my son needs more friends like you. So he's been one of my best friends since. But I ran that company like that for about a decade. I built it pretty big. I was on $5-6 million a year. And then 2008, 2009, 2010 came along and people weren't paying their bills, especially the commercial work. And I had 650 grand in AR. And back then I didn't know anything like Certain Paths or Nexstars or Clovers. These organizations, they existed, but nobody knew about them. So like all my numbers, I kind of made them up. Like every time I got a big paycheck, I just bought another double truck in the phone book. And I couldn't get people to pay. And I remember I was spending a day a week in court. I was taking business law classes that I'd already taken in school, trying to get freshened up. And I remember just one day I couldn't breathe and I was stranded on my couch. And this is after like 3 years of spending a day a week in court trying to collect. I had 650,000 AR on a $6 million company. You guys get it. That math doesn't work. And I couldn't breathe. And I remember I kind of like blacked out and I like came to, and I was like, I was at the airport at Dulles Airport, and I was like trying to get a flight and they wouldn't let me fly anywhere. And they're like, yeah, you can't fly. If they actually have a rule post 9/11 that like, if you don't have a destination, at least they did for a period of time, we can't sell you a ticket. And I'm like, really? And I'm on the phone, and my girlfriend, who's now my wife, was like, please just come home. And I came back and I was like, I can't do this anymore. And she goes, you know, whatever we got to do to make a life change, let's do it. This is 10 years. It was a hell of a thing. You know, you go to work and you do work and nobody pays you, and you do the job, you do everything right, you're running the company the right way, and just getting, not being able to get paid for work you did, is a hell of a thing. And I said, okay, cool. So I sold that company for peanuts. My uncle called me and I talked to him. He was from Northern Virginia. He moved to Texas with his wife. His girlfriend, his wife, ex-wife now. Anyway, I came down, I rode with him, and he was working for a big company called A Number One Air, and he was selling air conditioners, selling tech for him. And he's like, I want you to come see what we're doing down here. It's kind of cool. So I flew down here, jumped in a truck with him, and and I saw his paycheck stubs in his truck, and I'm like, you're making like 20 grand every 2 weeks. These can't be real. There's check stubs laying on the floor in his truck. And I started seeing his process and what he was doing, how he's running calls. Then the owner offered me a job. So I left and moved to Texas to go work for them, for A Number One Air. My wife came, now wife, she said, yeah, let's get the hell out of here. Let's go. So we left Northern Virginia. I sold my company for a little bit of nothing and moved to Texas. I know that's a long story.
Oh, you asked for it. This is great. This is great. No, yeah. I wanted to hear. I think people don't know enough about that background. I know I spoke to you, Beast, around you. Me and you've seen each other over the years and shared some stories. And I just saw you a couple weeks ago with your son, which was awesome to see you with your son at an event. He got on stage, and your great father, obviously. Chad's going to jump in here too, but I just got one more follow up on that. So here we are. You get done. You get this job, your business, some of all the struggles that happened, you go out, you're a great selling tech or a comfort advisor, and then you decide to go back in business.
You know, the catalyst really was about the first year I was there, I made like 250 or 300 grand, right? And I'm like, yeah, do this. Stop doing that business owner stuff. But like the whole time as an entrepreneur and having ran a business for a decade, I'm looking at this company that's growing. When I got there, we were doing like 22 million. By the time I left, we were doing like 35, and it's growing at this rate. And I'm like looking at all this stuff they've got. They've got this straightforward price guide, and they've got all these processes for how to run a call. And everybody knows all these metrics. My managers are talking all these numbers that I'd never heard. And I'm like, damn it. How do I not know these numbers? Where were they? And now I realized they were members of SGI, which is now CertainPath. It's like Nexstar. It's like Clover, one of these things. And I was like, I was just so mad that this was all out there and I never knew about it and didn't like have access to it. So I got it. I got, after the second year working there, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't sit still. And I'm like, I got to start another company. And my uncle was working there, and I was like, listen, dude, I'm going to start another company. And I even talked to the owner day one. He's still one of my best buds, James Green. He's a great guy. And I was like, hey, I'm going to leave and start my own company. He's like, all supportive. Let's go. He's like, and I said, but when we start this company, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to join SGI. That's going to be the first move we make. And I was just bound and determined to learn all these KPIs and all this data and all these numbers that I didn't know. Because I'd had all that suffering I didn't have to have if I had. Because I had the grind and the grit and the resilience. It just, I didn't know what I didn't know. You know what I mean? I didn't know what my gross margin should be or what my marketing budget should be. So, you know, you get it.
You're spending thousands to make the phone ring. But if your CSRs aren't picking up or converting, you might as well light it on fire. And what are the largest businesses in the country doing about this? They use Avoka, the leading AI platform in the trades. $100 million businesses like HL Bowman are operating with only 9 CSRs because Avoka handles up to 80% of the calls. Plus, Avoka follows up with your leads, grades your CSR calls, and helps you strategize. So my suggestion, go with the leading company, check out Avoca.ai. That's AVOCA.AI. Click the link below.
Yeah.
To the Point listeners, listen up. What if the biggest thing holding back your business isn't marketing or hiring, but your bennies? The benefits for home service companies, a better 401k can be the difference between great techs and losing them to the shop right down the street. Basic Capital, our newest sponsor, is the only 401k built to actually put your team on a real path to retirement. Companies that switch over see higher participation, happier teams, and dramatically low turnover because your crew finally gets a plan that's a true benefit, not just a checkbox. Don't wait until your best people walk. Make the move and click the link below to get 12 months with zero employer fees when you join Basic Capital.
So we left and I called Uncle Mike in to come and help me start a company.
So Josh, I think we probably, all three of us, can look back at, you know, when we first started and, you know, started getting all this training and all of this stuff, and some of it we probably listened to and other things we kicked to the side, like, ah, hell, that's not important. Like we can do all of these things. What are maybe the one or two things that, like, when you look back from when you started, and obviously you made the bold move to, hey, I'm going to join someplace that's going to like teach me how to do this.
Right.
Whereas I feel like I spent a few years kind of fumbling around trying to figure out what in the hell I was going to do until someone finally told me this is what to do. Okay, cool. I can do that. Right. What are the couple of things that, like, looking back, like, you're like, ah, I wish I would have paid more attention or put more kind of effort into building that out, and we would have been this much more successful.
You know, I'm crazy coachable, right? Like I look at Tommy Mello, right? And I'm like, dude, he is like just a lifetime student. You know, and it hadn't been cool to watch him grow. Like, you know, I thought, like, when he did his deal and stuff that maybe he'd peaked. And I went to his event the other day and he just keeps getting better, man. I mean, the guy's smarter than he's ever been. And I'm like, I've kind of felt like I had a plateau there at the end of my first company. And I had plateaued. I was defeated, and I was drinking, and I had a panic attack. I'm like, I don't shake, and I had a panic attack. And I think, like, James Green, when I was at A No. 1 Air, said, hey, he's like, Josh, you need to embrace some change. And I was like, caught me, and I was like a little sideways about it. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? Like, I remember not even knowing what that meant. I remember going to SGI, and they have a thing called executive perspective. And it was like the first day of executive perspective. They said, who knows what a KPI is? And I was sitting there and, like, I looked around the room. Uncle Mike knew. And I was like, I didn't know what a KPI was. And I was like, what's a KPI? And they're like, key performance indicator. And I was like, I have so much to learn if I want to crush it, right? And they recommended this book, The Dream Manager. And I read it, and it's a quick little book. If you haven't read it, it's a great little book. And I hadn't read a book since maybe ever. And here it is in like 2014, and I'm reading, and I read this book. It probably took me 3 months to read this book that's 250 pages. But then I had all this stuff to work on. And one of the things in there is an exercise called make a dream book. Hell, I have it right here. This is still the same dream book I've had since 2014. And one of the things I put in there was build a $10 million company in 10 years. Just a random goal. Get to $10 million in 10 years. And I knew that I was going to have to keep growing. And after I started exercising all the stuff I learned from the dream manager, I was like, damn, this is the, and then, you know, also with, you know, all the stuff I was learning at SGI, the next year we joined Nexstar. I'm like, every time I go learn this stuff, I learn a little, do a little, learn a little, do a little, it keeps working. So I got obsessed with that process, like reading books. If you look, I mean, like, people come in there, they see these all my bookshelf full of books, and they're like, you know, what's your favorite one? I'm like, well, what's messed up in your life, right? And I'm like, I need more information to tell you a good book to read. And then I was like, oh, if I learn a little, do a little, and I got obsessed about it, and I just kept doing it, and I kept pouring it into my people. And it kept working. So I think that was kind of the catalyst, was just this obsession with learning and doing and repeating and going to SGI, going to all the, I never missed an expo. I never missed a super meeting, never missed any of this stuff. Meet all the people I can meet guys like you guys and just like try to ask good questions and get better, you know, have guys that hang out with dudes that are crushing it where I want to be and try to get where they are. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I think the follow-up to that would be like, you know, I've come in contact with enough people who are at all the events, who are, you know, reading all the books, or we see them posting online and it's this, that, and the other, yet their company's still the same size 5-10 years later than it was. Obviously that wasn't the case for you. You know, hasn't been the case for really anybody on this podcast, yeah, which I think is great. But like, what do you think that, obviously in every good training talks about it, like, you know, like, why would you give away all your secrets? It's like, well, because only about 2% of them are actually going to do anything with them. Right. Like, what do you think inside of you has been that kind of catalyst for like, no, you said you're crazy coachable. I consider myself like, I remember when I first joined Nexstar and it was like, whatever John says, I do. I don't ask questions. I don't do any of this. Like, what do you think about you? What made you like extremely coachable?
Do you remember they used to give away those tornado, like 1951 retro tornado pins at Nexstar? They used to give away these really slick steel pins. Yeah. You had to put cartridges in them. I'd go to Nexstar and I'd have a handful of these cartridges in my bag because I knew I was going to run the ink out of my pen. I still have every single book. I have mountains and mountains of training books. I think even when I was younger, like when I was a kid, my dad used to always tell us, he's like, I'm master electrical, master mechanical, master plumbing. I'm master blaster. I was like, master blaster, what are we playing, like Mega Man or something? I didn't understand what the hell master, explosive license, like an unrestricted explosive. And I think it's just always kind of been in there that, like, you know, when I was at Lincoln Tech, I was top of my class. I think I was just so damn determined when I was a kid to like get the hell out of my situation and get to a better situation. I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it's DNA. Maybe it's, I'm not sure. Maybe it's a result of seeing other people's failures, having my own failures. I don't forget them, you know. I keep my foot on the gas, and I always have. And I don't know, man. I learn stuff and I grow. I just want to be really good in life, you know. And I'm not really sure where that drive comes from, but I'll have to ponder that. Where's yours come from?
Yeah, so mine's very similar. So I was, you know, did really well in school, did really well in sports. All of that said, I was never the best. Like, I wasn't the best student. It didn't come easy. I wasn't the best athlete. I was good, but not great. And I played with all these guys who were great in Division I and, you know, all of this stuff. And it's like, you like want a piece of that, but you know that like my natural ability is not going to get me there. Like, I don't know. Well, coming into the trades, I knew very certainly I didn't know anything about what in the hell we were doing. And so I was going to have to take that same mentality of, you know, school, it was like, I'll stay up and study. I'm going to work hard. I want to get the best score on this test. I want to beat the person who's supposedly the smartest, or, you know, be, you know, a better athlete or whatever it was. And so, like, I feel like for me, like, it was just, I know what I can control, and what I can control is the effort that I put into this. And so effort, I can learn all this stuff. Well, everybody learned the same stuff in school, but people got different grades on tests. And so it was like, well, the translation here is how hard I work, how hard I prepare. To me, that's always been just kind of the ingrained piece of like, hey, this is what I can control, and this is what I can do, and I'll effort you all day, every day of the week, regardless of what it is.
I love it.
Yeah.
Love.
Yeah. What about you, Aaron? This was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I wasn't great in school, so I wasn't top of anything in school, just so we're clear. That was not an area that I wanted in my. Yeah. I know. Plumbers were, you know, we're usually not the top of class stuff. I mean, I was always competitive. I played sports. I played football younger. I played all the sports. I love sports. I think I'm naturally just kind of competitive. And I think similar to, you know, many stories is like, I just wanted to get out of the situation I was in eventually. Like, I did not want to live the same way. You know, my mom was a good mom, but I just did not want to live in the same income level, the struggles, all the stuff, right? And it took a long time to get out of that. I had to go back and forth a couple of times, lost some stuff, gained some stuff. But eventually, once you kind of found the way, I realized that education was a pathway out while the trades were part of it, right? So learning the trade is an education. It's learning the tools, learning the master, how to master the trade, right? And then it moved on from there to how to master the next thing, the next thing, and next thing in business, because that was my downfall early on, was I just didn't understand business. And I think once I kind of found some models or listened to a business coach, like you said, like when Jim Hamilton would tell me something, I just did it because I was like, I don't know any better. And I'm kind of just, a dumb plumber, you know, for lack of another term. I'm not saying that rudely at my own trade, because I am, but I'm a plumber. I don't know any better. And I'm just going to listen to what this guy had to say. I'm going to go do it. And I think what happens a lot of times is people get too mixed up messages these days. They listen to too many different things. They're not sure. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of mixed up messages. It was really like the only person I talked to was my business coach, because there wasn't all the other platforms and all the other stuff going on, right? So I didn't have to have competitive comments or disagreements. I just did what he said. And I think it's great that all the information is available now. It's just sorting through it and then deciding something and do it. And I think we are products of what I think Nexstar's mission was, right? We are all products of it. And we just followed the template and we went to work, right? And I think that can happen in any of these programs, by the way. The problem is a lot of times people don't fully commit. And my belief is once I fully committed, I was able to get the outcome, right? And because I was already competitive. And I also came to a reality that I didn't know any better, and I wasn't going to let my ego try to be in the way just because, I didn't know, and I thought I could figure something out better. So I think over time, it just kind of fell into place and just went to work and just followed everything they said. And eventually we evolve, right? We evolved into the next level of the businesses as that's gone on. So, but I think to answer the question, I don't know where it all comes from either. I think some of it's just built in the DNA. Some of it is where you grew up, and some of it is just naturally, you just want to be better at everything you're doing every day and still learn. And I think a lifetime learner is important.
You know, you said something, you say you learn something, then you get to work. I think the get to work side of it is where most are failing in, is because they learn stuff. We're all learning stuff. This, I mean, like what we do for a living, the information we have, the information any of us share, none of that's even new for the most part. I mean, if your bullets fit my gun, I'm shooting them. But you got to get to work. And people don't get to work on this stuff. Like I don't have a lot of pet peeves, but one of them is people call me and asking for help all the time, and I'll pour into anybody anytime. Cause I mean, that's how I got here. Just don't ask me the same question 6 months or a year later and tell me you're having the same problem and you still haven't hit the gas with the stuff I gave you last time. And that's the only real peeve I have. I'll coach you. Just don't ask for the same coaching and not take it. You got to be coachable, right? And get to work.
Well, I think there's an addiction to learning sometimes and listening that has happened a lot. I've been through it. I think all of us have on this at point in certain points, right? Get addicted to it. But the problem happens is that people don't go to work. Right. And so what I did, I'll just share something for me through my Nexstar journey too. And some of my membership, I spent about 3 years just addicted to everything, learning everything. I'd fly to any shop, anybody would let me come. And then I stopped and I went to work for a couple of years. And I don't know if you guys kind of remember there for a little bit, like I was involved with a lot and then you didn't see me anymore for a while. Yeah. Like I was around, but not around like I was.
Yeah.
I went to work and I just went to work on everything I possibly could. I stayed in contact with different people that I had relationship with, and I learned and I check in. And you know, I think people were always lots of great members, and people have always been open to help me. And I think, like your point, I was very coachable. But I went to work, and if I called somebody back later, I sure wasn't going to call them back to tell them that I didn't do what they told me. Or if I was calling them back, I'd tell them what happened and why something worked or didn't work for me and what could I do to adjust it, right? And I think that's what most people want. Like all of us are open to coach anybody. It's frustrating when you tell people to do stuff and then they don't do any of it. And then they come back and you're like starting over. So I agree. The art of just doing has been a little bit lost. I don't say lost. It might be unfair, but because I don't want to say that for everybody, speak for everybody. But I do think sometimes you got to shut off all the noise, focus, and go to work.
I think what we're saying here is it's not that people aren't working hard. I always look at it as people, if there's 10 things to be working hard on they choose the three easy ones instead of the seven really hard ones that, like, listening to every call and making sure that we've got this dialed in and holding people accountable and all of these things that are actually going to build your business. And I think where we got lucky is, and I'm just thinking back on, like, you know, 2015 to 2020, like 2015, when we started, like, there wasn't any talks of, like, hey, how to build leaders in your companies and how to do all of this, you know, all of this stuff. It was like, no, you need to run the calls, put the best tech on the calls. They need to convert. They need to do these things. And, like, there's so many people that have, and it's not their fault. It's, I think it's like information overload. And you're also hearing it from, like, their, you know, I have so many people that are, like, you know, taking advice at, like, what. Now, I remember those days and what we did there, but, like, what I'm doing today, like, those are different things than what you need to be focused on at your, where your journey is. And so, like, I think it's about, like, this stair step of, like, hey, these are the things, and you can go see a shop that's a lot bigger, but maybe find the one that's, like, 3 million bigger than you are and go figure out how they got from where you are to where that is. All the while, you can still go look at the big ones to be kind of get that vision, get those wheels turning. Like, there's just different like pieces of the puzzle that you've got to fit together properly. Or if you get one out of whack, then it's like, well, we don't have any money to do all this other stuff. It's like, well, yeah, no joke. You're not booking any calls type thing.
Or a guy who's running
Sorry, Josh, go ahead. What you're saying, what he's saying there, what did you do? Did you do that too? Did you go find shops like a little bit bigger right away? I mean, I know we met very early in DC, just chatted over time. I don't even know how we just stayed in contact randomly. I don't even really know how or why. We just hit it off and we just always stayed in contact. Obviously, you're a great guy. But what did you do as you started to march along that journey to get a little bit more into that? What did you do?
I think what I was doing was like, all right, so here, I'll tell you a little story. Like, I was out on the loading dock here yesterday morning, and I've had a guy who's working for me. He's a great guy. He's a good salesman. And he's sitting there, and he keeps talking to me about starting his own company. He's like, how'd you and Mike start that company? And I said, listen, when Mike and I started this company, we had zero. We had no business whatsoever. So we went to, like, we joined a chamber of commerce. We went there, and we told everybody, and we did, like, a home show. And, like, every single customer I went to, Mike and I both, I mean, we probably had a $9,000 average ticket. I mean, and this is just giving me a random ticket. I mean, you guys talk about the quality of the calls or something. I'm like, shut up. We ran any stinking call we could, and we did it at an elite level. I got 5 5-star reviews on every one. Nobody had talked. I was like, this guy's name's Ed. I was like, Ed, when's the last time you used your agenda card? Why is your closing ratio? I don't care. It's 60%, right? Come on, dude. You're closing at 60%. And this is on demand calls. I'm like, I couldn't do work the way you do work right now. Your work ethic's a problem. You need to slow down. You need to take your time with customers. You need to do everything at an elite level. Like, if you do everything at an elite level, you might just maybe be ready to go think about starting your own company. Like, I was one of the best selling techs at A No. 1 Air. And this is at the time, they're the biggest air conditioning company in Texas. And like, I was so meticulous about every single thing I did. And I've been that way about the whole business the whole time. That's like, I think the guys that win are just anal and off the deep end about everything in their company being perfect and not making any mistakes and asking what the mistakes that you could make are and escaping the pitfalls. I mean, how many dudes do we know that want to add plumbing when they're running a $5 million air conditioning company? And I'm like, you're not even running a good air conditioning company. You want to add plumbing. You should be elite at this one thing you're doing before you try to do two things mediocre. Like, come on. Like, it should, you know, like, when's a good time to add plumbing? When you're elite at air conditioning. Like, when you're elite. Not, and everybody wants to say, well, when you have this many calls or this much marketing, this many customers. Sure, that stuff's important, but are you even elite at what you do? Because now you're going to go run another average company, like, and then you're just going to plateau forever. And you're just going to be an $8 million company for the rest of your life with two trades. And I guess maybe your ego is satisfied, but like, that didn't help your growth trajectory. Like, I don't get it. Be elite at stuff. That's all. Maybe I'm quoting Jocko too much here.
I think you're speaking the truth on that topic. I think that's a myth that people have done. I saw that coming up through the industry early on. That's why I stuck to plumbing for a very, very long time. And I think even Chad, when you're at our office, when we were growing the plumbing business only, I literally said, don't suggest that the peer group to add HVAC or any other trade. We're going to do one trade and we're going to own it until we're the best, right?
And then I suggested it in the worst summer in the history. And you kept calling me going, why did you do this?
I talked to him. He's like, it's good. You should do it now. Don't worry. Memorial Day, it'll be so hot. You'll be so busy. Da-da-da. Nothing happened. I was like, dude, nothing's happening. Like, literally nothing.
Nothing's up.
Life comes at you fast.
I agree with you, though. People get way ahead of themselves a little bit on that. So
we did HVAC for a long time before we added plumbing. We waited a long time. And then I bought a plumbing company. I was like, I'm not going to go hire some plumber. I'm going to plug a company in, and then I'm just going to massage it into being us over, like, it took about a year of massaging to make that company our company. The guys started seeing the wins and doing things right.
I think I'm on a little bit of delay here. Something's going on with this, but about what size were you when you added your plumbing trade, Josh?
We were doing 11 in HVAC, and a good opportunity came to buy a plumbing company up the road. And we were elite. Like, I was like 24% net at 11, and we were growing huge. We were retaining customers. We were retaining employees. Our culture was fantastic. Go buy a plumbing company. And I bought a really strategic one. The way I bought the company was smart, really smart. Like, I ran it co-branded for almost a year. We said, you know, Rescue Air, if somebody called in on the Texas Green Plumbing number, I said, you know, Texas Green Plumbing, now a proud partner of Rescue Air. And that's, we didn't change anything. Didn't make the plumbers do anything. Just, you know, let them get all their wins. But we went from 11 to 22 in 1 year. I bought a $1 million a year plumbing company, and just their database and being able to outbound to them and sell them air conditioning and sell our customers plumbing. We doubled that year from 11 to 22, and we did it really, really healthfully. You know, we were 4.2 EBITDA. So
that's amazing. Actually, there's a good strategy right there. It is laid out.
But again, all of what you just said is all blocking and tackling, outbounding to our customers, cross-selling, all of these things that like get lost in the shuffle of how these businesses are built.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one more thing you got to go do and worry about when you have multiple trades. Like, it's a lot to add a trade to your company. People are so excited to do it, and it's all ego. I don't think, or maybe they think it's an easy button. Either way, ego or easy button, they're both bad ideas. Don't do egos and easy button moves in your business.
I'd say adding trades is not easy. It's not as easy as people think it is. Even if they're in the same domain, plumbing, HVAC, and electrical, they're just not that easy to do. They definitely shook our business up. I mean, we still grow. We dealt with stuff. But for about 3 to 4 years, it was an interesting journey from being a plumbing only business that was doing around, you know, 45 million dollars in plumbing and drain only to adding in these other levels. And our plumbing business and drain business still been growing, but they definitely shook some stuff up for us for a couple of years trying to get those trades in. And they took a big, it took a financial hit. It took an energy hit. It took stuff. And I get worried for people that do it too early, because I'm thinking, here we are, a dominating plumbing business with great margins, killing it with EBITDA, doing really well. And we add these trades and they suck you. They suck your profitability down for a while. They really unstabilize your business and structure. They take your attention away. So people do it too early. It can put you into the bottom, right? Fast. So I think it's a great principle to make sure people really think about that, or listening to this show, thinking that a trade's going to save their business, or adding this other trade will make me better. You know, there's a time for it. And I'm not discouraging people from doing it. There's a time for it when you want to kind of own the home, for that old language they used to use around Nexstar too, and around many places. But I think it's a strategic move, right? It's got to be the right time that vertical makes sense in your growth, in your growth journey. So when you think about now, are you doing, do you guys do electrical now? Are you starting electrical? Where are you guys at in that?
Just the generator side of it.
Just the generator? Okay.
Just generator. Yeah. We don't really mess around with the rest of it.
Josh, I think you put it perfectly to your point, Aaron. It's not as easy as saying, oh, well, we're just going to bring in another trade. you're running a completely different business. So if the business that you run isn't giving you enough headaches and enough stress and enough this, that, and the other, maybe you look to create a new business under the same name. And I think the way that you did it is so apt. It's like, no, we were running two separate companies for a year until we felt like, okay, we have our arms around this. We can bring them together. And I think that that's true. I mean, you think about plumbers, electricians, HVAC guys, they're all different. It's there's a lot of similarities, but there's also differences that you have to learn to master and learn to figure out.
We were probably a year before we even rewrapped their trucks. Think about that. We ran a year before we even wrapped the trucks, Rescue Air. And they we waited till they wanted it. Like the plumbers were begging for it. Until we could literally say that, like, every customer, we sent postcards, the dual branded postcards to all of our customers and all of their customers for a year. I was sending them monthly. That we were outbounding. We called every single customer at least 10 or 15 times and told them the good news. We put video everywhere about the deal. Like, we made it such a, and then by the time we did it, there was no confusion.
No, it's a great strategy on it. I think that people need to understand that as they move forward into these next chapters of their business. And I want to move forward into another part with your business, if you don't mind, Josh, into, obviously you went to a private equity partner. I remember when we talked a lot during that time, me and you were back and forth a lot during that time. And I appreciate those conversations there. I learned a lot talking to you while you were going through your journey. But one of the things I think people hear is all private equity and culture. And I think you were able to adapt to moving into a private equity deal, which I think you could speak to as much as you want, or at least amount as if you want about that deal. But then the culture, be able to move over all these things, culture doesn't work. These things happen, but it seems like you transitioned that very well. Your culture, from what I've seen from the outside and talking to you over the years, has stayed pretty steady and strong. So maybe speak to about that transition in the organization, because you're very open about it. So your employees know, people know, it's not some secret thing, right? So maybe you could speak to that as maybe people are into that next chapter now and what that looked like for you and how you handled that moving forward.
So it was December of 23 and when we closed, but I ran a full process. Like, I hired an investment banker, which is, if you don't know what an investment banker is, it's pretty much, for anybody listening, it's like a real estate agent for your air conditioning company, right? So they go out and help you find the right deal. So they put together a deck and they build it, and but, you know, first thing I'd tell you to do if you were thinking about doing a deal, go read the private equity playbook. Everybody has probably heard this one. I've read that book 7 times and it's highlighted front to back. I could probably sell my copy that's got everything highlighted up in it. And then go read the art of selling your business, read Built to Sell. There's a lot of things that you'll find out that they're looking for. You need to build your business a way that an equity company, private equity company, wants to buy it. And you can't get too personal or attached to the stuff that you think's important, because that doesn't matter. It's the stuff that the buyer thinks is important is what matters, right? So build your business the way they want to buy it. And if you go out and run a full process, and when you set out your deck and everybody gets to look at it, right? It took a year. It is a flipping grind. If you don't have a data room, I don't care who you are out here listening to this, start making a data room now. Figure out what one is and build one. Because if you don't have a data room, it's going to take you a long time, and they're going to look for information for your data that is 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. That information, you might not even be planning on selling your business down the road. If you don't have this stuff accessible, they're going to ask you for like documents from the state from 5 years ago. And while you're trying to find all this stuff, it's going to affect your ability to run your business correctly. And then they do a thing called retrading. Right. And they'll change the valuation on your business from where, whenever you land on whoever it is you want to talk to. But we had those dinners and people came in here and sat with us they'd come visit our shop for a full day, ask all these questions in the conference room. Then you'd have a big dinner that night and it'd be a 2 or 3 day ordeal with each one of these companies that you were courting, if you will. And then you try to figure out who you want to get in bed with. And we had 22 offers initially, whittled it down to 13, then 11. And then we finally got down to our bottom three. And I mean, the stress and anguish and challenge, how hard it is to run a full process to get top dollar, is something special that it was one of the hardest years of my life. And we married the right partner. I've stayed on now as general manager for 2.5 years post deal. And I really just did that because everybody told me I couldn't. And I was like, I can get along with these guys. Let me prove it. All these other suckers out here can't get along with you. I can get along. And it's been challenging, right? Because a lot of the decisions you make are about today and today's money and answering like it's planting long-term seeds. You don't do that stuff the way we used to. And a lot of this stuff that gets handed over to the private equity group is they're building out the platform. We're not the platform company. They're not nearly as good at a lot of things as we are. You've heard these stories from everybody who's done an equity deal. The nightmares of it, you know, and people making it 3 or 6 months with it before they split from the equity company. I'm 2.5 years. Yeah, about 2.5 years post deal. You know, it was December of 23 and here it is June of 26. And I've had a good ride. It's one of the best decisions I've ever made. I mean, I've got legacy wealth, if you will. I rolled a lot of equity back in. I think that's a really smart move. But you're going to be married to it. So you can't get any ideas about like going and starting another thing or, you know, buying a business up the road. You're going to have to kick that can for a long time. So it's going to buy a lot of your life. They don't just buy your company. They're buying a lot of your life away from you where you can't go do anything. But I think it's been cool. It's been a cool ride. I do it 100%. I do it the exact same thing I did again. I wouldn't change a thing about it.
That's awesome. You know, I appreciate you sharing
secured my family's future. You know, my kids' kids will be in a good spot as long as I don't screw up my kids. So that's a whole other conversation. That's a different podcast.
Yeah. I met your boy with you. I don't think you're doing that. We'll talk about that later. But you gave me a great book on legacy, and I appreciate that when I saw you. So
I ordered a copy. I'm meaning to mail it to you. Yeah,
I got it.
Do you? My man, Leaving a Legacy. My buddy Patrick McGee recommended that to me over lunch about a month and a half ago. And it's like the origins of charity and legacy. And it's got biblical references throughout. It's a fantastic book. Chad, you got to read this one. It's
That's awesome.
The right way to look at wealth and how you create generational wealth. One of the best books I've read probably in the last year.
I still listen, man. Come on, baby. I still
listen. And that's what I'm saying. You got that. Have you read it yet, though?
I haven't yet. I only saw you a couple weeks ago.
It's a 3-hour read. You read that book in 3 hours.
Okay. All right. I'll tell you what. I'm going to read it in the next week and I'll call you. All right.
I know you're
calling me out. On a podcast, calling me out now. All right. I know Chad's got to jump because he's not coming up, but I got one final question. Chad, if you got to roll, I'll wrap this question up for him.
I'll jump and you finish this out here.
All right.
See you, Josh, Chad. Great seeing you, my man.
Chad, good seeing you, buddy.
Right. See ya.
All right. So we got to wrap up with the question that we've been asking everybody on the podcast lately is, what is wrong in the industry that nobody wants to admit?
Yeah. Gosh. I'm going to try to not get stoned. Man, I'm pretty direct and honest about things. What's wrong in the industry nobody wants to admit? I would say in the private equity side of the business is private equity can't look at and love our customers the way that we do. And I think that's how I built this thing. I made every customer promises, handshakes. That's how Ara was when he sold me ServiceTitan. He said he'd never fail me and he'd always take care of me. And he has. I think humanity is failing one another right now. If you turn on the news, everybody's against everybody. If you drive down the highway, you see people just not treating each other with respect the way we once did. I think people have become too disposable. I don't think we love each other enough. I don't think we have God in our lives enough. I don't think we're praying enough I think what's wrong in our industry is that we don't look at our customers as human beings that we care about as much as we're looking at them as a ticket or a revenue or a number, and they can see it and they can feel it. And I think it's why people cancel their memberships, because somebody's always trying to sell them something, or you keep rescheduling my membership because it wasn't the highest value ticket. We had to go, you know, we had to load our board the right way. right? And what did we say to a customer that we made a commitment to? And I think it's dirty and I think it's ugly. And I think the sooner we get back to our roots where we really take care of our customers and we each take care of each other. And I don't know what's going to correct this world, but I think the thing nobody's talking about is that nobody's treating anybody else as good as we once did. And I think we need to get back to that.
All right. Well, great message, man. I appreciate it. It was awesome having you on here. I really appreciate it, man. I love to get a chance to catch up. It was great to see you a couple weeks ago and love your stories, man. You always got great stories, my man. So we'll talk soon, my man. I appreciate it. We'll see you guys all next time.
See you, Aaron.
What's the password?
Don't talk about it. Be about it.